because what I'd like to do is move on to John Edwards, who is head of international communication practice for Herbert Smith Law Firm in the City of London. He is one of the most generous people with his time. I'm really grateful that you were able to come along tonight. He's going to offer some discussant remarks. He was intimately involved in the Foresight project that we were all involved in, I dare say in your spare time, but he brought together other people with legal expertise and with insights into these systems that we're talking about. And I think I'd be very interested to hear what you have to say now.
Thank you, Robin. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very interested to hear what both Brian and Jim had to say. And I've got some general remarks, really, which I will lead on to, but I just wanted to refer to two or three points that arose from the earlier discussions. Jim's description of the need to, if you like, coordinate the development of information security across an organisation raises really the whole question of responsibility for that, raises the question of IT governance and, indeed, who really should be carrying the can for all of this. It is, at the end of the day, a risk management responsibility. And indeed, there are some very good materials produced by IAC, Information Assurance Advisory Council, upon these issues. But the legal basis for this responsibility is, frankly, quite thin. And it tends to be rather one of those areas, as industrial relations used to be 30 to 35 years ago, where the board really don't want to know because they think it's beneath them. And it's a lower level techie thing. And I think one of the issues that has yet to be grappled is actually placing the responsibility at the right level in the corporation, i.e. at board level, and making it a board level responsibility. I have floated in various fora, various extravagant ideas of how that might be done addressing, for example, perhaps the three prime movers within a senior corporate executive's mind, greed, vanity and fear, by linking, for example, performance in this area to some form of compensation, bonuses only allowed by ABI, for example, in respect of those corporations whose board have got a good record for IT governance. Vanity by dishing out knighthoods in response to this instead of other incentives. And fear by, you know, criminal prosecution if you get it wrong more than once. 7 days in jail concentrates the mind of any aspiring CEO. But it does seem to me, interestingly, at a time when the Chancellor has tried to scrap the obligation to produce an organisation review, which seems to be going the other way, and yet in a government that claims to be going for joined-up administration, a bit of an anomaly. In his discussion, Brian talked of proof of identity, and I picked that expression up in order to focus on it as a non-legal concept, because I would take that to be proof of identity to a level sufficient to generate confidence. This is a whole issue of cyber trust, and proof is what proof does, really, and in the course of my work in the Foresight project, the legal group came up with a notion of trying to inspire confidence by use of generally accepted digital principles, borrowing the idea from the accountants. And proof of identity, if you like, operates in that way. Robin, in her opening remarks, graphically illustrated the need for cooperation. In other words, all of this is really only going to work if the population are happy to go along with it. And at that point, I'd really like to switch across, bearing that thought in mind, to my more general observations about this area. And I do so as a lawyer, and I say, first of all, what has the law got to say all about this? Or indeed, what should the law say about it? Or perhaps, why has it got anything to do with the law? Both Brian and Jim, in their respective talks, were looking at issues arising in the course of online activity that will result in either interruption or damage to or failure of effective online transactions, or unintended consequences for bona fide competent participants, which one seeks to avoid. Jim was focusing on vulnerability to online crime. Brian looked at the broader issues arising from problems with effective identity management. But these thoughts lead to the question, what may be needed to achieve online robustness in all spheres, for commercial and social interaction, for effective interaction with government and other public agencies? Let's just take from Brian's talk one strand of his talk, looking at the whole question of secure process of establishing ID at enrolment. Whatever the detail of the process adopted, it seems reasonably clear that to be effective, the process is likely to be intrusive. Techniques of fingerprint or iris recognition, for example. And this is where the cooperation of the population, of course, is really needed. As individuals, we feel this process is intrusive, and we don't really like it because we've got some expectations of privacy. We feel the integrity of our persona is violated by the process. But why do we feel that? We feel that because our expectations are based upon an articulation of human rights that's been developed over the centuries. Magna Carta, Bill of Rights, the European Convention of Human Rights have all built these ideas of human individual integrity and rights and privacy. But perhaps the answer to this problem is that those rights now need to be re-articulated in the context of the present and future online world. Not, I'm suggesting for a moment, in any way to lessen or diminish them, but to re-establish them in a new context. When we are asked to put our eye to the lens, when we are asked to offer our fingerprint, we realistically, in many situations, have no real option. And therefore, we will do it, or we may even willingly do it, because we want to participate in the exercise which we are seeking to enter by this process. But although that right, if you like, that human right, that expectation of privacy, is lessened by that process, we can perhaps, instead of creating a situation in which the two aspects are at odds with one another, where this process is in conflict with our human rights, we can re-articulate our human rights in another way by accepting that infringement of those rights on the one hand, but balancing against it a remedy or a rounding out to make us feel better, to make us feel whole as a result of the process. If you think about it, what you really need, therefore, is some sense of accountability on the part of those who are undertaking these exercises. Another way of looking at it is also that you might re-articulate human rights by reference to new lines of responsibility and liability in the course of the interaction. That's another way of looking at it. I don't pretend to have the answers on this at all, by any means. If you're looking for accountability, bearing in mind that much of your interaction may be with the government or government agencies, it's pretty clear the accountability has got to be outside the scope of the government of the day. Perhaps the answer may be that we do need a written constitution. A written constitution which actually articulates our human rights in the modern context of an online society. That's just one thought. In the Foresight Project, I was happy to have the opportunity to consider some of the issues, some of the legal issues that arise from online activity with a number of colleagues of considerable greater eminence than myself. As I mentioned, we were able to come up with the idea of generally accepted digital principles. We looked at other ideas, such as if, for example, you are online active, you have a responsibility, as you have a responsibility when you're driving a car. You need a license to drive a car. Why shouldn't you need a license to be online? The simile is not exact, because you can actually walk in the road without a license. Perhaps, therefore, you need a license for broadband, but not for dial-up. I don't know. But I won't push that one too far. But we looked at other ideas of, if you like, trying to regulate or get the benefit of regulation for society. By all means, look at the short piece at the end of the magnificent book which Brian and Robin were responsible for, which had a number of ideas. But if you like, trying to give security through some semblance of legal apparatus. It's very easy to contemplate mechanisms that are unworkable, over-centralized, bureaucratic and too expensive, and therefore you have to find some sort of compromise. And that really is a summary of my observations.
Thank you very much. I think we should clap for you too, Professor. That was very provocative as well. Yes.
From my understanding, DNA is likely to provide a very much more statistically provable unique identifier. But most people seem to think that it's considerably more intrusive than even the two that we're considering now, fingerprints and iris scan. Whether society will start to realize that much higher grade performance is worth that intrusion, which actually, with better techniques, is likely to be minimal, because it's no more than a piece of hair. I personally think that we could find ourselves in 5 years' time finding that a much more acceptable and reliable biometric than any of the two we're considering now. And that's why I don't want, personally, to see us building a whole structure on what is currently regarded as the best, when that isn't good enough.
Excuse me interrupting. I mean, I don't know that if the technology would... Presumably, I would have thought for DNA, you'd just spit in a bucket, wouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah. There's all sorts of ways of getting hold of a sample of you.
Yeah. Yes?
How sure you are it's the person who...
Yes. Good, yes.
DNA certainly is vastly more intrusive as a biometric than fingerprints or iris scans, because it gives you all sorts of information about the person, the individual and their family, than those other biometrics.
Gives you information.
It gives the person who... It gives anyone who can obtain that DNA sample. Yes.
Precisely.
On what the gentleman on the left was saying about human rights and re-articulating them, I'm not sure that... you know, the primary purpose of human rights isn't about accountability and liability. It's fundamentally limits on the role of the state and intrusions onto individuals' freedoms. I don't think you would find many German human rights lawyers, for example, that would recognize what you were saying as a re-articulation of human rights. They would say you're talking about fundamentally changing.
I would absolutely agree with you, but what I'm saying is it's time for some new thinking. Because we're faced with new problems and situations, and the actual essence of what we're talking about, okay, the actual concept of a degree of freedom that you feel comfortable with is perfectly attainable in that way. It's just that, if you like, perhaps the development of human rights so far has become rather rigid.
I would fundamentally disagree. You know, it's the same as when Tony Blair says, today's circumstances. We must fundamentally rethink things like parliamentary scrutiny of legislation and judicial oversight of court processes. They said, well, what is really so unique about today's circumstances, including the internet, that justifies overturning 1,000 years of constitutional and human rights law?
Right, this is where I could get into my forte with my knowledge of new media and justify all this, but I will refrain. I think maybe we'll take another question, and that we could, because sure. I think this one could go back
just,
and forth. Yeah.
Could I just come back on the DNA bit before we lose it?
Mm-hmm.
What makes you think in 25 years' time you won't be able to buy your own DNA analysis kit from Boots?
I think probably buying.
In which case, government doesn't control DNA analysis of any sample that anybody leaves lying around anywhere. So your privacy is dead in that sense.
No, I disagree. It's one thing to say that people can get a hold of a hair or a piece of skin you've left behind can analyze your DNA. It's quite another to say you have it stored in a centralized government database.
Yes. My database.
Jonathan, you didn't
no,
have
I
your hand up?
Actually raised the same.
Oh, okay. Then you?
I'm going to ask a question about the crime. There are some crimes which are very clear, almost everybody is clear that they are a crime. But there are many other things where many of the people may be aware that it happens to technically be a crime, but they're not necessarily technically thinking it's wrong. And speeding is moving into that category. buying underage drink, for example, is something which people might want to do on the internet because it's easier. Do you draw a distinction between the crimes that are generally accepted or not? Because internationally there's no consistency on what's a crime.
No, I think you've raised a very important point. I think it's the boundary between formal and legal issues and moral and ethical issues. In fact, we've touched on them from another direction here. But certainly in a large corporation, in a large enterprise, there's an awful lot that goes on which is in that sphere of informal and cultural, what do I call it, manifestations of what the company is, what the enterprise is, and what is what certain behaviour that might be might not be illegal, but it might be unethical and inappropriate. And for all kinds of reasons, corporations and public sector organisations are very concerned about those for reputation reasons, not least of which. So I think the proposal is really more not specifically about combating crime as such, but developing a framework for dealing with information risks, which may include the risks to the reputation of the organisation, and the organisation would want to be able to deal with those. So I think I'm looking at it more generically than just simply a criminal question.
Mm.
I'd like to ask. Your talk's focused on corporate and public sector databases and the question of managing information in those environments. But could you comment on joke logs on the street who increasing numbers of people getting broadband access? How do we go about raising awareness of cybersecurity and cybercrime to that particular group?
Well, I think the awareness for the ordinary citizen, I think it's coming anyway. I mean, their daily experience with online activities is coming up and bringing up into their face the need to deal with security. You're only got to look at the sales of antivirus programs, the Symantec and McAfee profit figures and so on. Increasingly, the banks and their online banking, internet banking facilities—they're almost giving them away, giving away security. They're using security as a means of selling their products. So I think there's certainly need for more education. That's true. I think it needs to be included in what goes on in schools. I think there needs to be more specific treatment of information security in the school's curriculum. Important. It needs to be done. The generally accepted digital principles would be part of an endeavour to spread good practice, good secure practice amongst large populations.
Steve, do you want to say something about it, Safe?
I could just make an investment for Get Safe Online, which is a general awareness campaign, and in particular IT Safe, which is a government alerting service for pharmacies, firms, that sort of thing.
I think one of the problems, especially with the development of electronic IDs for, and this is across Europe, for e-government generally, is the usability issue. That the problem with security is it makes functionality more difficult than it would be without it. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And I think increasingly as e-government comes about, there is a problem with how does the ordinary citizen deal with the complexities of navigating their way through these kinds of systems that are even more complicated because they've got to be secure. They've got to be handling tokens or cards or whatever technology is going to be used, and they've got to be handling it safely. And as a footnote, I mean, that in a sense, that problem was the the death knell of the much vaunted public key infrastructure, because how was the individual going to manage their private key on their own PC or whatever it was? And
I think there is a bit of a view that the younger generation will somehow grow up with a greater awareness of many of these issues. But we have research here at the LSE which has looked extensively at what's often called internet literacies, and it's very uneven in terms of the way in which children are developing those kinds of skills and awareness, and to some extent has to do with the not surprising finding that, of course, lower income families are able to enable their children, for the most part, to gain fewer skills, etc. So there are all sorts of issues, and it's not just a generational issue. There's a question here.
Sir, I apologise for missing your lecture. Bad traffic. However, one of the issues, the political issues, has been that people are afraid that the security bandwagon, in this case, may grow and grow, and the amount of data which is incorporated into, shall we say, the security project area, likewise grows and grows. To your knowledge, is there a way to mathematically almost prove two things? One, can we mathematically prove that we, what the set of data is that is required for, if you like, fulfil the requirements? And the second aspect of that is that in the good old days, we used to use techniques like CORE, Control and Requirements Expression, down as VITEC CORE, for requirement modelling. Nobody uses it these days, they just use packs of envelopes, which is a little bit of a shame. But the thing is, in those days, you used to be able to prove exactly what your requirements were. And I'm wondering, is there also a way of proving for the security paradigm exactly what the requirements are? So from my perspective as a systems designer, I know exactly how far we actually have to go. Because somebody made a comment about projects going on in this realm for sort of several years, and that's always the designer's nightmare, because you never finish. It goes on, you know, ad nauseam forever. And you've got a real problem there. You know, is there a way of actually restricting the data so that we can say for this area we know exactly what we are going to need to fulfil this defined security paradigm, as opposed to politically they want this and this forever. You know.
Could I offer some thoughts? What people do use is UML as a way of capturing a link between the alleged business requirement and business process description, and the systems development models. Where there is work going on is to look at formal methods to prove the internal consistency of UML, which at least makes sure that what you construct is internally consistent and is well aligned with any description you might have of user requirements. The other work that I'm aware of that's going on is to then look at the perceived value of the data that exists within that model. It's still a model, of course. And in that sense, you can prioritise where you apply security controls of a suitable strength and complexity and cost of ownership and development. It's, to my knowledge, that's not completed work. That's work in progress. And it only really works on relatively small-scale structures. So, and a fairly obvious conclusion from that is, if you haven't got a clear definition of what this lot is supposed to do, you will certainly not apply good security to it, because you won't have a clue why you should apply any security to any of it, unless you have a really good description of what it's for. Martin, you have a research lab that works in this space. What do you think?
Not a hope in hell.
But you can do a little bit.
We do a little bit. Actually, can I come back to the cost question that was raised? Because IT spend on security has been going up year on year. Do any of you actually think this is going to stabilise, or it's just going to become an increasingly high percentage year on year, and maybe even accelerating as a percentage of total spend?
No, I think it'll.
And if it is, who pays?
It'll stabilise. Has to. It'll be the balance between risk and insurance. Yeah. I mean, it's like you know, credit cards. Why have they moved to chip and pin? Because the cost was getting too high.
Yeah, I think if you define security as the balance between cost and risk, the balancing out cost and risk, there isn't an absolute spend, and there's not 100% security either, because even if there were, you could maybe chase that will-o'-the-wisp and try and capture it, but there isn't. So you're always left with having to sort of balance up what you can afford and against.
Do you believe you'll be able to achieve the same levels of security we have today? Or
I think there's a lot more been learnt about how to run secure organisations than there were 5 or 10 years ago. Yeah, I think a lot of progress has been made.
We do it in our physical infrastructure. It's a question of what's tolerable and what's acceptable.
Yeah.
And you've heard these words very recently. We find any deaths on the road unacceptable. We tolerate 30 a day because we're not prepared to spend more. We could spend more and reduce that number. And any death is unacceptable, but we tolerate 30 a day.
But it doesn't. It depends a lot on the time frame here.
Oh yeah.
I mean, if you postpone the risk out into some future generation, then you can make a rational calculation today. But I'm supposed to be the chair, so I recognise a question from you, Greg.
Yeah, you're talking about the balance there between cost and risk, and of course that's the perceived risk on both sides of the debate. Yeah. And you talk about the time frame. Isn't one of the challenges here that actually in the public debate there isn't really much awareness of the actual cost and risk of the existing patchwork quilt of identity? It's not as if we're moving from a perfect system, we're moving from far from it, a very imperfect and costly system. And all those costs, including costs to our own privacy, are not counted in the debate. What would you like to comment on that?
Well, you say it's imperfect. One of its strengths is its diversity. If you lose some part of your identity, you probably don't lose all of it. One of the criticisms of a new national scheme is it's all put in one place, and if you lose any of it, you lose all of it. So there's no diversity in it at all. So architecturally, it's a very different model. So it's quite difficult to work out what the social risk as opposed to the procedural risk.
Well, isn't that a very judgmental way of putting
yes.
it? If you put it
oh, yes, way, I know it
if
is.
You, if you put it the other way around, it equally stops you in completely legitimate circumstances consistently verifying the identity of individuals that have happily provided
well, we've not
data.
We've not worked at trying to solve that problem.
So inside every department of state, a huge amount of cost, redundant cost, is consumed.
Different credentials.
That have
I just taxed, put a new tax disc on my car online, and it took me 7 seconds, including the payment. And that checked the MOT, it checked the insurance, it checked I was the owner of the car, and took my credit card payment. 7 seconds on a Saturday morning. I was delighted with that. Now that is two commercial systems and two government systems linked up together, which weren't designed to be linked up together, but have been made to work. Brilliant.
And you know that we could also give you a very long list of systems that don't today.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
And we as taxpayers pay hundreds of millions of pounds having those reconciled manually.
There are existence theories on both sides of the fence, absolutely right. But to say we've not examined whether we could join up our existing ones, I don't think is true either. We just haven't done a particularly good job at trying in certain instances.
But I certainly agree with you. I mean, I think that my experience of looking at identity management developments in the European area, generally looking from the European directive onwards. And my feeling is what we have is some very clear visions emerging about what these identity management systems are going to look like technically. There's increasingly a vision emerging about what the legal and regulatory framework is going to be. And again, shades of PKI here, you know. But there's no social vision, there's no political vision, there's no cultural vision, there's no sense of what the role of the citizen is going to be, what power the citizen is going to have,
spot on.
As Brian rightly said, in terms of at what point of the interoperation does the automatic side of it kick off, switch off and allow the intervention and discretion of the individual citizens to say, yes, I am prepared to allow my personal information to go from here to here. No, they're not thinking about it. There's no thought being given to that. It's not being, because it's not important. It's not seen as important. That's my feeling anyway. And I think when we get the idea of maybe reconsidering the whole story and saying, yeah, maybe we do need to look at a social contract here. I've got great sympathy for that. But at the moment, that's my understanding of it.
Looked at from another vantage point as well, and it seems to me that whenever we talk about the degrees of consent that the individual might wish to give in these systems, we're increasingly relying on the individual to spend their time thinking about these things. And the evidence is that people don't want to think about these things. And so then, again, you know, we may be wanting to respect their right to choose, but they don't actually want to spend their time doing it, which is a bit of a catch-22 situation.
But you could have a default. You could say, look, my default is I'm not bothered. And everybody else said, well, I am bothered. I want to be able to participate.
Yeah, I agree. Good. Yeah. There's a question from Steve, is it? And
yes.
Then the gentleman behind also.
Right. So really just following on from that, Fred Piper, I think very eloquent, makes the point that technology is neutral in all of this. And in fact, you know, any security mechanism you put in can either be used for good or for bad. And what seems to be happening is that the more stringent technology we put in, the bigger the risks are at the same time. And I just wonder whether this pursuit of security is actually something that we shouldn't be over-egging, and that safe security, if you like, is a shibboleth. Mm. And in fact, we do need to look more at these cultural issues, these limitations to security, to make sure we end up with something that we actually have to live.
It's proportionate, yeah, and it's difficult because information isn't valued.
I think it's interesting that you should say that, because I always took exception to the notion of something which was bandied, a term which was bandied about for many years, privacy-enhancing technology, coming from the same kind of domain that you've mentioned. And that's not put forward as a neutral, it's put forward as technology that is inherently good.
Yeah.
I don't think I disagree with the notion that any technology is inherently good. I think it's the context in which it's used and how it's used that determines where it falls on the moral agenda.
Mm. Someone in the picture?
I suppose following on from that, I was just talking about there is this issue that we tend to forget about the risk aspect, that we can accept, you know, that we don't do something. I spent much of the last year writing papers saying what I do is that I'm not going to do anything more because it's not cost effective for me to do anything. I'm prepared to take that risk. And sometimes quite a difficult thing, but again, can't be carried away with the same, we can do this and solve this problem. That's particularly a problem, I think, with technological solutions, because we implemented a technological solution, but only as far as we wanted to go, because whereas the biggest problem is a people problem, and the issue there is it's not really a cost issue at all. It's an education issue, it's just something completely different. So we just basically stopped and said, this is as far as we're going to go.
I think it comes back to the gentleman's question here at the front. It's not possible to specify a system in formal terms where you have a user, where the model of the user isn't anything other than extremely limited and mechanistic. And in reality, users are not extremely limited and mechanistic, and neither is technology one-dimensional. The use of the technology in its context alters the nature of the technology. It also alters the nature of the user as well. And that's the problem. You can't capture that with V&E's development method, specification, whatever it is. You know, with the formal specification, mathematical specification of languages. Because you can't specify human behavior mathematically. That's the problem. And the system is not just a technical system. There's a technical part, then it sits inside a social and organizational mush. And that's the problem.
Social science terminology. So interesting. There's a question at the back, please.
One of the possible I'd like to take from Brian, because I think your comments about contacts online, which I agree is not a but my real question was, I felt his presentation left a great big question hanging, and I wondered if I could just ask him whether he wanted to say, in terms of what his next slide might have said, had he gone beyond the headline. Because basically, the presentation pointed out some real difficulties and obstacles and limitations. With current technology available. But then the punchline was that nonetheless we could do something about it, the current world. And I guess my basic question was,
what? I think it goes, good question, I think it goes back to the beginning, which is to specify very precisely and maybe in a somewhat more limited way
what a national identity management service, and I've suggested these words to the Home Office, a personal identity management service should offer government departments and other large commercial organisations. Because everyone is interested in understanding how to manage personal identity in a transactional context. Whether it be because someone is thought to be a criminal, or whether it's a high added value commercial transaction, or establishing rights for a public service. And were it to be so branded and minimised in terms of its complexity, in other words, the inverse of that, made as simple as possible so that its chances of success and the chances of the user experience being good were increased significantly over what most experts, and I'm not the only person in this space, most experts are saying the current card scheme is headed for, which is high levels of complexity, lack of definition of what it's for, and an imprecise participation of user communities in how they might establish it. If you can invert all of those things and drive them to a simple, objective service, then the chances of success of improving personal identity management, I think, will go up significantly. So that's what I would do.
Okay.
And I've said as much to Catherine Courtney.
I think we've opened up so many issues. We could have a number of more further seminars, I think, easily in the program around the issues that have been raised. I was wondering, John, do you have any final thoughts?
Just in all of this, I think what your opening words, Robin, I thought were key, which really is the cooperation, the consensus of the population in anything that we create. And in fact, interestingly, though people are conscious of invasion of their rights, they frequently, quite glibly, are happy to go along with that in exchange for the benefits they perceive they get from that. So that I think that's why I believe some degree of flexibility in this is needed when you go forward. And certainly some systems of accountability and accountability beyond the scope of the government. I agree with the gentleman on the floor that the government's own articulated concept of accountability may be inadequate. I think accountability to history and God is not in itself sufficient. One needs rather more than that. And indeed, my proposal for a written constitution would certainly involve that.
Thank you. I think the language in which we conduct these debates is really important. I had a conversation about rights and responsibilities and the internet sitting in Dubai a couple of years ago. And the occasion was a very international collection of people coming from the Middle East and coming from, the wealthy industrialized countries as well as the African subcontinent. And we could not have a discussion with people remaining in the room if the word privacy was used, or rights. But if we talked about accountability, if we talked about rethinking principles, if we talked about responsibility and whose it might be, people were happy to sit around and effectively talk about issues of privacy and of rights. Mm. It was just the language that they were not able to come to a common agreement about what they might mean. And I think it's always useful to remember that, whether we're sitting in London or we're sitting in Dubai or wherever we may be, it is actually possible, I think, to think about some of these profound issues in a way which not only moves forward technologically, but also moves forward in terms of sort of common understanding of what should be our practices in the 21st century around all of these issues. Mm. That's my thought. Any final remarks from James or Brian?
No.
Okay. You happy? Well then, I would like to thank you, the audience, and for coming, and I would like to thank EDS for sponsoring our program, and I would like to thank James, Brian, and John for some really insightful remarks. Thank you.